Everybody, James McCanny here. This is my science hour for April 4th, 2024, and this is a very special lecture. It's going to be used as an introduction also for coursework, and as any of you know who've been following my work, I have astronomy, astrophysics, space science courses on my webpage. But something very special is happening in a couple days. On April 8th, there's going to be an eclipse of the sun, a total eclipse. I've been discussing this on my last few shows, but this show will be used as an introduction to a course that's called Eclipsed: The New Cosmology and the Death of Old Cosmology. In other words, the Big Bang cosmology with general relativity is dead. It died a long, long time ago. But the problem is that the monopoly of science, that is just a huge industry, huge business, government supported with the peer-reviewed journals in lockstep with peer review professors in universities, etc. The problem is that they have simply locked this up. And I want to start this out by saying just a couple of things. All of the information that I'm presenting here was available in 1979. And I was presenting this in peer-reviewed published papers and got boycotted, basically, when I was at Cornell University. I had made all of the discoveries that I'm going to talk about in this lecture tonight. Everything, was available at that time, although it took me some time to put other pieces of the puzzle together. But this is an interesting article I want to start out. This is just a recent article in the Indian press. In other words, now this is from India. Okay, so this is what it says. It says Karnataka from India. Anti-Big Bang theory scientists face censorship by international journals. I'm going to read that again. Anti-Big Bang theory scientists face censorship by international journals. It says, scientists from across the globe, including India, who are refuting the Big Bang theory on cosmology, are facing resistance and censorship from journals and archives of international repute where they get their research papers published for peer review. And then the Big Bang theory holds that the universe was born out of highly compressed, dense, microscopic point called a singularity, which exploded with the force some 13.8 billion years ago, resulting in everything arising from that singularity moving outwards in all directions. From this, all cosmic matter as we know it today was formed at different stages through time until now. And then I'll just skip a couple paragraphs. Then it says 24 astronomers and physicists from 10 countries, including reputed astrophysicists, and goes through a whole series of names and qualifications of academicians, says from India are among scientists protesting the censorship of papers that are critical of the Big Bang hypothesis by the open print website ARXIV, which I'll read the next paragraph and then get back to the lecture. As scientists engaged in the study of the cosmos and relation of phenomena in space to those here on Earth, we strongly protest censorship of controversial papers on cosmology and specifically on the Big Bang hypothesis. Run by Cornell University, ARXIV is supposed to provide an open public forum for researchers to exchange pre-publication papers without undertaking to peer review them. And so that goes on to talk about how these many, many physicists who are trying to get their papers published are being rejected and censored. Now, welcome to the club is all I can tell you. You know, these people don't complain until it affects them. That's what makes me kind of go crazy over this whole issue of cosmology, because the Big Bang should have never, ever been started in the first place. It should have had very, very minor roots when Edwin Hubble first saw, if Edwin Hubble was the first person to put spectrometers on telescopes, he had the best telescopes. This is in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and then, of course, special relativity came along, and we knew about redshifts in light before that, but Einstein clarified that with special relativity. But basically, what Hubble did is he put a spectrometer on telescopes, compared the spectrum of galaxies with the laboratory spectrum of known elements like hydrogen and other known elements that are in stars, and saw that they were all redshifted. So he said, that looks like everything's moving away from us, and therefore the universe must be expanding. And that's where it's got its birth. However, that should have been short-lived, because they never looked for another source of redshift. And that's something that I did, and actually put it all together, because when I was at Cornell in 1979-81, the Voyager spacecraft were going by Jupiter and Saturn, and I saw the electrical effects. I realized that those two planets were not planets, but like they were small stars with ongoing fusion. So the fusion had to be in their atmospheres, not in a dense core. And so that meant that the sun's fusion was up in the atmosphere, and there were electric fields that were generated. The fusion process itself generated a current of protons, and that's what they call the solar wind, something that, for example, Einstein, up until the time he died in the mid-1950s, did not know about. If he did, he would probably have been able to surmise a few more things. But anyway, I'm going to get into a lot of these topics along the way. But my point is that censorship by the peer review journal system industry has been going on. Now, I was at Cornell literally 45 years ago, if you can imagine that. That is how long this ruse, this hoax, this cosmological hoax has been going on. And they've been able to abate any criticism. And now here we go, this recent article in Indian Press, and this is from India, the country of India. Once again, anti-Big Bang theorists are being censored in the international journals. So anyway, what I want to do now is I'm going to go down the list of all of the reasons why the Big Bang should have never gained any momentum in the first place. Now, just let me discuss briefly cosmology as it currently stands. You have the main pillars of modern cosmology, the redshift that is observed, it's actually observed throughout the universe, of galaxies, of quasars, high redshift objects. And what's really the cause of that? Is it because these things are moving away from us, or is there some internal property of these objects? And that's where the crux comes in, because everybody that's really looked at this under a, just peeling back the first onion layer, has realized that the redshifts don't make sense if you interpret it as being related to velocity moving away from us and distance. All kinds of contradictions pop up. For example, our own sun has a redshift at the edge of the sun. And that's and that's been known about for a long time. And so that questioned the interpretation of redshift. But nobody had an answer until I came along and proposed, and with laboratory experiments verifying it, the induced electric dipole redshift. So the pillar that Hubble built, Edwin Hubble, not the Hubble Space Telescope, it was named after Edwin Hubble, but Edwin Hubble proposed the expanding universe, and that, at the time, was reasonable. But it should not have lasted very long, given the further information that was gathered. Another pillar of cosmology, as it was taught throughout the last 105 years, 110, 115 years since Hubble, was that it was eventually discovered that there was a microwave background radiation, in other words, microwaves coming to us on Earth, apparently from a distance. And so some people did some calculations, And they came up with a 3-degree, in other words, a black body radiation, which is the following. If you took a metal container and painted it black and looked at the infrared radiation coming off of this black body, it would have a certain curve to it. That is called black body radiation. And very cold black body radiation has a certain signature, a certain spectral signature to it. And there is a signal coming to us on planet Earth from out there, from somewhere, that has this 3-degree signature. And so that was heralded. Nobel Prizes were given for this, for predicting and then measuring. And once again, this looks like all very, very solid physics. But there are flaws in it. Flaws that, once they started coming up, were erased, because the background radiation should have been perfectly even all across the universe, because it's had 13 billion years to neutralize, just like the sun's surface. When the sun was first observed scientifically, it was this orange ball, and they expected it to be perfectly smooth because of the core fusion model of the sun, where they said the fusion of the sun is taking place in the core. Okay, so that would mean, because it would take millions of years for X-rays to emanate from the core, being absorbed and retransmitted, then the surface of the sun should have been perfectly smooth orange ball with a 6,000 degree temperature, which it looks like from a distance. But once you start examining it, there's all kinds of turbulence. There's tornadoes racing across the surface of the sun, magnetic anomalies, holes that develop where the temperature is much cooler, and on and on and on. So the core fusion model broke down. It should not have worked either, which was one of the pillars of modern cosmology, the cause of fusion, that all of these stars and galaxies are emitting light that is sourced by the fusion reaction, which is small elements building up and releasing energy. But there was all kinds of major problems with that, because the sun doesn't have enough mass to produce the light equals mc squared. You're converting mass into energy. The sun doesn't have enough mass to continue doing that for very long, especially down in the little core. So all kinds of physics anomalies have cropped up. Contradictions that should have told scientists, something else is going on here. So anyway, the microwave background radiation is actually due to a cloud of dust that surrounds our solar system. And that is the source of the microwave background radiation. It has nothing to do with the Big Bang. So another one of the pillars of modern cosmology is simply false. They were looking at data. They interpreted it one way. That interpretation turns out to be false. But once things get printed in a peer-reviewed journal, it is, and especially given a Nobel Prize, it is like platinum. That is the holy grail. You cannot contradict that. And if data comes along that contradicts it, after all, we're dealing with science. If data comes along and contradicts that, what happens? They take that data and they mold it. They either throw it away or they mold it to fit the theory. And that's what happened with the microwave background radiation, because when they looked at it, first with the COBE satellite and later generations of microwave satellites that went up into space, not just receptors on Earth, what they found is that the microwave background radiation was not perfectly even. It was blotchy. And then so there were all of these excuses for why that is. In fact, another Nobel Prize was given for someone who came up with the excuse for why the microwave background radiation is not perfectly smooth. So the excuses, the Band-Aids, so to speak, kept being put on a theory that should never have been permitted to continue back in the early 1900s. Another pillar of modern cosmology is general relativity. Now, I've talked about general relativity before, but basically there are many aspects to general relativity. There is the space-time continuum. There's curved space, tensor view of outer space and gravitational fields, how space is distorted by gravity, by the presence of mass, etc. Very excellent work. All of that very true, but there's a part of general relativity that is incorrect. And that is when they talk about the bending of light, that light should bend around gravitational objects. The famous elevator or the example, the Gedanken experiment, the thought experiment that Einstein came up with, which he was very good at. Also called the principle of equivalence. So the general relativity, it turns out, has some very good portions to it, but the part where they say light is bending in a gravitational field is false. And Einstein himself was opposed to general relativity because it did not contain the whole field, which would include electricity or electric fields and magnetic fields, which abound in outer space. That's why Einstein was very interested in the work of Velikovsky, his good friend at Princeton. And so Einstein, when he died, had everything pushed aside on his desk, and he was reading Velikovsky's book, Worlds in Collision. And this is a few years after Velikovsky's book had been published and went basically ballistic internationally, as the modern term, it went viral, being published in 14 languages. But Einstein realized that there was some key in what Velikovsky was doing that was instrumental, essential to understanding how space really worked. And he was looking for that because he knew that gravity did not bend light, that did not cause redshifting of light. But don't tell that to the peer-reviewed journals. And this comes back to an experiment done by Arthur Eddington, which was done during the time in May of 1919 at a solar eclipse. And this brings us round robin back to this topic of the eclipse coming up this coming April 8th. What Eddington did is he took his equipment. This is, by the way, during World War I. There's a lot of difficulties, a lot of difficulties. And he had an associate whose name was Dyson, D-Y-S-O-N. They both took equipment and they went to different locations. Dyson went to Africa and Eddington went to an island out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean where they were going to take photographic images of the total eclipse of the sun. The idea being that the stars should move outwards, radially outwards, when the eclipse is occurring, and comparing that to that same region of the sky, the star patterns, without the total eclipse in that region of the sky, without the sun there. And supposedly, they proved general relativity. The only problem is, Eddington faked the data. Now, general relativity is a very, very important aspect of cosmology. That's where you get black holes from. That's where you get the warping of space-time. You get the precession of the planet Mercury. All of these things. And now there's a new study that deals with stars that are in elliptical orbits around Sagittarius, the center of our galaxy, talking about precession also. So this is where general relativity comes in this the idea that space is distorted abnormally, much more than Newtonian gravitation would suggest. And this has to do with a combination of special relativity and general relativity and space-time, etc. So, and there's also other so-called proofs using pulsars that orbit each other, etc. However, once again, there are other explanations for this. And for example, Mercury has a tail, something that you don't hear a lot about. Our moon has a tail. And this is a tail like a comet. Now, what is the effect of a tail? Because when I did my physics and understanding what a comet really is, it's the discharge of the solar capacitor. Little Mercury is close to the sun, and that discharge causes it to charge negatively because of the excess current of electrons in the discharge. And so the end result is that mercury is picking up mass, and that tail drag is what's causing the precession of mercury, not general relativity. So all of the pillars of cosmology, of what you might call modern cosmology, which is not so modern, it's been around for 120 years, literally, since 1905, well, 119 years, excuse me. So the end result is that the pillars of cosmology are simply not there. And so what I'm going to go through here is a whole laundry list of issues with modern cosmology. And this is the introduction to a course. It's called the first level course in astronomy, astrophysics, and space science, which is available on my webpage, and for a very reasonable price of only $89. Now, this course was developed with the sole purpose of exposing things, and one of the big things it does is it talks about galactic structure. When you look at a galaxy, these beautiful spiral arm galaxies, now we have photographs of literally hundreds of billions of these. Literally, estimate with there are photographs now of up to a trillion galaxies with the Webb telescope, with the Hubble telescope itself, etc. So just vast numbers of galaxies. And the one common characteristic they all have, except some that are distorted by nearby objects or something that is causing them to be distorted on one side, the one thing they have in common, very high percent, extremely high percent, like 99.99999 many times 9%, is that they have symmetry. One side of the galaxy is the same as the other. In other words, if you put a mirror in reflecting the one side of the galaxy, you would get the mirror image of the other side of the galaxy. Perfect symmetry. Well, how does this happen over distances of hundreds of thousands of light years consistently? And so my very first peer-reviewed public paper dealt with that issue. And so I'm not going to go through that. That paper is available, reprinted in the appendix of my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes. But the whole issue is that standard cosmology does not explain the symmetry of galaxies, something that is absolutely important. It's absolutely fundamental. So anyway, the reason for galaxies to exist, according to standard cosmology, is they say there are interactions. In other words, you take a massive amount of particulate matter in a plasma, and you take another one that supposedly is clumping together after the Big Bang, and you bring them together, and magically, this creates a galaxy because of the interaction of one to the other. But the only problem is it does not explain galactic symmetry. In fact, every time you see a galaxy with another object near the galaxy, the second object is distorting the galaxy. It's not making it symmetric. It's destroying the symmetry. And so the idea that somehow these things always perfectly come together to form a spiral galaxy with perfect symmetry is ludicrous. Like I say, every time you see a spiral galaxy with something near it, that nearby object is distorting the galaxy, not making it symmetric. So just basic observation tells us that that concept, which was around when I was at Cornell, 1979, that same concept is still around. But there's some basic problems with it that have been discovered and just swept under the rug. So the end result, according to standard cosmology, is that beautiful spiral galaxy is like a record disc. It is spinning around as like a solid piece, and, you know, not following gravity, because it turns out that the nucleus of the galaxy has very little mass compared to everything that's surrounding it. So how does all of this material orbit something that is much smaller than everything that's in orbit? It doesn't make any sense from a celestial mechanics point of view. What my model shows is that there is a fluid flow around this central object. And no, it is not a black hole. What's going on there is redshifting going on, but it's due to the non-uniform electric field that surrounds the galactic nucleus that is undergoing fusion, just like our star, the Sun. Okay, so at any rate, once you take and peel back the first onion layer of modern cosmology, nothing makes sense at all. So what I'm going to do now is go down through the list, just a very long laundry list of issues with modern cosmology. And then what I'd like you to do is, once you finish listening to this lecture — this is an introductory free lecture, basically — then go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and purchase. It's called Eclipsed, the New Cosmology. That's the title of the product, and it's a series of lectures. It's a series of web pages that allow you to track the new cosmology. So it destroys the old cosmology and replaces it. And that's what's really important, because it's relatively easy to criticize things. It's really difficult to replace it with all of the necessary things, the hundreds and hundreds of things that you have to explain that are observations. They're clearly observations. There is a redshift. There is a microwave background radiation. What is the cause of all of these? And the thing is, it all comes back to one central part of my theoretical work, and that is that in a fusion reaction, there is an excess current of protons coming off the object, which creates a capacitor. That is the cause of everything. Once somebody asked me what my main major discovery is throughout my career, not talking about prime numbers or other fields like archaeology, but in terms of space science, astronomy, astrophysics, the most important discovery I made while I was at Cornell, watching the data, looking at my theoretical work, was that there is a generation of a capacitor around fusion-based objects, and how that proceeds with an excess current of protons that creates this capacitor. And when that capacitor discharges, that's where you get all of these effects. Okay, so on with, once again, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, order the new product. It's called Eclipsed, the New Cosmology. And the reason I talk about eclipse is because central to all of this is redoing the Eddington experiment. So amateur astronomers can do this. Most amateur astronomers have equipment that far exceeds the quality of what Eddington had back in 1919 when he went to a remote island. And plus, you have the advantage that you're much more mobile. You can go to a place where you have clear skies and nice weather for the eclipse, and take the photograph of the total eclipse with proper equipment, with proper filters. Never look at the sun with your eyes, even your naked eyes, or with any kind of optical equipment. Never use. And so this is for people that know what they're doing. I'm not going to explain that other than just say, do not look at the sun during a total eclipse with your eyes. You need special equipment. That's as much as I'm going to say about it. And if you don't know what that is, do not look at the sun. Okay, so once again, the webpage, jmccsci.com. Go there, buy the new product. It's many lectures with visuals, with exercises, with problem solving that you have to go through. It's called Eclipsed, the New Cosmology. Okay, so now continuing with the structure of science today, one of the biggest things you have to understand is the tier level of science, and I call it tier 1, tier 2, tier 3, and tier 4. There's probably a tier 5 also, But basically, Tier 1 science is military science. That's what I call it. That's kind of a slang term. But it's the science that you never see. You will never see it in a History Channel special, National Geographic. You will never see it in a textbook. You will never see it in a peer-reviewed journal. You will never hear it from a tenured professor in a university. Tier 1 science is done by groups of scientists that have been basically plucked out of the ranks of scientists, and they sign a contract, and they are under gag orders. They do not talk about anything they do. And here's a good example. Here's a good example. I was at American Geophysical Union meeting. There was a session dealing with solar physics. That's where I mainly presented when I was in giving talks and discussing my work at American Geophysical Union meeting. So it was dealing with solar plasma physics. And the guy was giving his talk. And after he got done, he had mentioned that when he gets done with his research, he has to send a report up to this kind of invisible group of oversight scientists. And so somebody in the crowd said, well, what did they say? Did they agree with your work? Did they say you did okay or what? And he says, oh, no, they never respond to us. We don't know if it's good or bad or if they used it or anything. So there he admitted that he knew that there was this group of scientists above him overseeing everything, but to which he had no communication. He sent, but they never replied back to him. And that is from the Tier 1 level of science. They're picking the good stuff, and if they like it, they use it. If they don't, they don't. But they allow these Tier 2 scientists, that would be the guy giving the talk or somebody you see. My general rule is if you see their face or name, they are not Tier 1. You will not see Tier 1 scientists published in peer-reviewed journals. You will never see their work in a textbook. The Tier 2 science, I call it the garbage science, they pass off to the public. That's the NASA's. That's the a lot of people at Goddard Space Flight Center or JPL or other university professors that get NSF or NIH grants. Or National Science Foundation grants. That's Tier 2 science. They spend a lot of money creating this false layer of science, Tier 2 science. Okay, so what normally people think of as top layer science, or NASA flying the space shuttle or building Saturn V rockets or moon rockets, whatever, that is Tier 2 science. That's what the public gets to see. And that's what most people consider the top level of science. Tier 3 science would be, for example, educators, university professors, high school teachers that read out of a textbook. They don't really do research. They just repeat. We call them textbook repeaters. And they pretty much just read science. They probably have a certain amount of advanced degree education, etc. And then there's Tier 4 science, and these would include journalists, outreach agents of the science community, of which there are many, little people running around defending science. You see them all over YouTube videos talking about rah-rah NASA, all of this. That's Tier 4 science. It's the talky-talky science. Look at how good NASA is. And all they do is repeat the talking points. So you have to understand the tier level of science, understanding that what you see and what you get to see is not real science. It's the garbage science. It's the Tier 2 science that's pawned off on you, the public. That's where your tax dollars go, you think. Now, Tier 1 science is there are real people. They might live next door to you. And you don't know it. They go to work. You don't know where they work or what they do. And let me tell you where those people come from. When people are in, say, grad school or moving into a PhD or getting postdocs, they're being watched. And the good ones very soon are plucked out of there and put into Tier 1 positions. They sign a contract. They make a lot more money. and then they're hooked. You'll just never see them or hear from them again in terms of science. So you have to understand the tier level of science to understand that the Big Bang cosmology is garbage science. It was always meant to be. It was always meant to be the one of those things, you know, just like, say, UFO science that you see and, oh, they're going to release all this information. No, they're not going to release any information to the public about anything. It's all smoke and mirrors. So you got to understand that. If you understand that, then everything else falls into place. So the cosmology, the way it is explained today, modern cosmology, the Big Bang, the microwave background radiation, Nobel Prizes, awards and grants, and published papers in peer-reviewed journal, that's all the garbage science that's pawned off to you, the public. So the first thing that people will say to me as a critique is say, why don't you publish in peer-reviewed journals? Because I'm a tier one scientist and am recognized in many, many different fields as a tier one scientist. I've been around. My theoretical work is well understood in tier one levels as being correct. So that's what you have to understand, is you have to understand how all this fits together. The jigsaw puzzle that is it's relatively simple, but can be relatively complicated. Okay, so now I'm going to go through a long list of items here. I've already mentioned Edwin Hubble and the redshift, how he misinterpreted that. And the real explanation is what I discovered when I was at Cornell, the induced electric dipole redshift, is the redshift that Hubble was observing. It is not due to things moving away from us at large velocities. It's due to fusion-based objects generating an electric field, not just any electric field, it's a non-uniform electric field, and that is the cause of the redshift. That's the cause of the redshift at the edge of the sun. That's the cause of the redshift in comets, and that's the redshift of many different effects in outer space. So the idea that the universe is expanding and you can see it with a redshift is simply false. Eddington's experiment, which supposedly proved general relativity, was faked. Eddington cherry-picked the data. If you look at the original data of Eddington, the star movement was all over the place. Some of it was in towards the sun. And so what did they do? They did a statistical analysis, and they basically, that's kind of a good way of saying cherry-picked the data. And so 105 years of science since 1919, when Eddington did his experiment and announced his results, has been based on faked data. And nobody has ever revisited the Eddington experiment and redone it the way it should be done. And so literally, the one of the main pillars of modern cosmology, which is Einstein's general relativity, simply, much of it is true. The curved space-time, the tensor analysis, the Minkowski mathematics, etc., all of that is very good. But the part where you talk about bending of light around gravitational fields is not true, because the bending of light is due to the same effect as the induced electric dipole redshift. The bending of light occurs around the sun and other fusion-based objects. And by the way, Jupiter and Saturn should be also doing this, the same thing, in which you can actually observe this. And there are laboratory experiments that can prove the induced electric dipole redshift in a laboratory. You can actually measure it in a laboratory, something you cannot do with Einstein's general relativity. Okay, so pillar number two, the Eddington experiment, general relativity relative to the topic of curved light and black holes is false. So there are no black holes. That is a figment of a bad experiment done by Eddington. My next topic is dealing with something called Chapman physics. Now, this is a buzzword because there were two wars going on between the European camp, headed by Hans Alpen, who was a Nobel Prize winner, dealing with electrical phenomena, plasma phenomena in outer space, and Chapman, who was resident in the United States. In the United States, Chapman physics won out. And here's basically what it says. If you have a charged object in outer space, it will not remain charged for very long because very quickly, free charge in the plasma environment of outer space will come to neutralize it. And that's true. That is very true. However, it is not the whole story. Because if you have a engine, the sun, a fusion-based object, which is creating a battery, then there is going to be a capacitor. And what happens is that the battery around the sun takes the form of a nebular ion cloud. What happens is the proton wind sweeps the dust particles and the bigger particles out of the solar system and holds it back in a nebular ion cloud. That's in my original papers from 1979. And that ionized cloud with the UV light from the sun is becoming ionized. It's an ionized plasma with the proton wind coming off of the sun, which is our star, or would be the same for any galaxy, galactic center, fusion-based stars, etc., would create this electric field, and the discharge of that electric field causes all kinds of phenomena such as comets. Comets are the discharge of that field. Our weather, we would not have weather if it were not for that solar electric field. That in turn charges our own atmosphere. We have the vertical electric field of Earth. A lightning itself is a result of cloud systems discharging that vertical electric field between the surface of the Earth and the ionosphere. It is the cause of the ionosphere. It is the cause of wind currents that we call the jet streams, and on and on and on. So the Chapman physics, although it had a correct lemma, it had a correct supposition that charge in space would be neutralized very quickly, it did not have the full story. And when you have an object charging in the discharge of the solar capacitor, there's a simple rule, and that is because the electrons have the lowest charge to mass ratio, they move the farthest, the fastest. So the bulk of any discharge is electron current. And that means that whenever you have an object in that path, it's going to resist the electron movement and become electrically charged negatively. That's why comet nuclei are negatively charged. That's why, and the discharge is very rapid, but it maintains because the capacitor has much more stored energy than the little comet can discharge in a short period of time. So Chapman physics is incorrect. It is not the whole story. It has a basic principle that's okay. This leads us to the axioms of astronomy. Now, I was in the middle of publishing my papers in Cornell. I'm a faculty member. I'm now in the mathematics department. The only person that I'm aware of that taught in both the physics and the mathematics department at Cornell University. I was the only person in the mathematics department at Cornell to publish in peer-reviewed astrophysics journals, something that nobody had ever done in the mathematics department. And so, anyway, it was in the course of interchange of letters between myself and editors of the European journals. And by the way, it was my discussions with Hans Bethe, who was in residence, Nobel Prize winner, who is in residence at Cornell University. I had many discussions with him about the core fusion model of the sun. And he realized that there were problems, and when I was getting to the point of publishing my work, that the solar fusion was up in the atmosphere, he directed me to the European journals because I was being blocked in the United States from publishing my work. And so anyway, in this exchange with the editors of the European Space Science, Physics, and Astrophysics journals, one of the editors wrote back to me and said that with the belief system that comets are ice balls, because I was contradicting that, with the belief system that comets are ice balls, it makes one wonder if astronomy qualifies as a science. And he said, it's more like these are axiomatic starting points, that you have to start with the accepted theories or you cannot get published. So I developed the concept of axioms of astronomy. So the incorrect aspects of astronomy are that space is electrically neutral, that comets are dirty snowballs. That's what standard cosmology says. That's not true at all. Standard cosmology says that gravity is the only force in the universe, something that Einstein understood was incorrect, and that the solar system was formed all at one time 4.5 billion years ago. That's another of the axioms of astronomy. And you hear people talking about these all the time, like a nursery rhyme. And all talking points have to come from that. And this brings us up to a guy named Carl Sagan. When I was at Cornell, I really never met Carl myself, even though I was up in the space science astronomy buildings a lot and working around NASA scientists who were there resident. They didn't teach. They were just resident there because NASA had a presence at Cornell. But Carl Sagan was in Hollywood making the Cosmos series, which solidified the concepts that they wanted to push for cosmology. And so that book, next to the Gutenberg Bible, is the most read book on planet Earth. It's also the most watched documentary on television. So that was pushed. The only problem is that everything Sagan said in there is wrong. It's just simply wrong. But what it did is it solidified cosmology and all of these axioms of astronomy that everybody would have to follow for the decades and literally centuries to come. Now, this brings us to a guy named Velikovsky. Now, Velikovsky was, anytime you bring this guy's name up, it is death. It's the end of your career. Now, when I was at Cornell, I didn't know who Velikovsky was. I had been out of the country teaching in a university, and that's, in fact, why I was hired at Cornell in the faculty. I was hired because of my experience teaching university physics and mathematics at the university level in foreign languages. So I was fluent, and that's why they hired me, even though I had a master's degree. I'm not going to recount that story. But then that allowed me to be there and publish my papers. But I didn't know who Velikovsky was while I was at Cornell, 1979 to 81. But I later got to know Warner Sizemore. Warner Sizemore was Velikovsky's private secretary during all of the years at Cornell. All of the years when Velikovsky was at Princeton. And Einstein and Velikovsky were neighbors, basically. And Einstein would come over to Velikovsky's house and eat supper and play the violin before supper. And Warner Sizemore was there. He saw everything that happened with Velikovsky. He went with Velikovsky on his trips. He recorded the lectures. He made notes. He understood everything going on with Velikovsky. And he is the one that told me about Einstein and Velikovsky. Now, the reason Einstein was very interested in Velikovsky's work is because Velikovsky was talking about ancient texts where they saw electrical phenomena up in the heavens, comets, electrical activity, and of course, Velikovsky was dealing with rudimentary astronomical knowledge of the day. One of the biggest mistakes Velikovsky made was by trying to explain from astronomical terms what was going on with the ancients, and he couldn't do that because the information just was not there. Looking also at Einstein, Einstein was in his last years when he was at Princeton and was studying Velikovsky's work, trying to eke out something, and of course, he didn't have enough information. Einstein did not know about the solar wind. He did not know about the fusion on the sun. They had some rudimentary ideas. Einstein's friend, when I would talk to Hans Bethe, he would talk about Albert. And Einstein and Hans were good friends. And so, of course, Einstein died in, what is it, 1954 or 55. Hans Bethe was very young. Bethe was on the Manhattan Project. Einstein was not on the Manhattan Project. Einstein initiated, his letter was the thing that initiated the Manhattan Project, but Hans Bethe actually worked on the Manhattan Project, dealing with calculations and fusion rates of reactions, etc., for which he eventually won a Nobel Prize. So Einstein was interested in Velikovsky, but what I'm saying here is that anytime you bring up Velikovsky's name, everybody scatters like cockroaches when the lights go on, because they don't want to have their career ruined. The only thing is, I don't scatter because I know Velikovsky was very right. And I'm going to stand up, and it was damaging to my career. Can you imagine? I'm at Cornell University. Sagan had just got done destroying Velikovsky with the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting just a couple years earlier, basically burying Velikovsky. And then Velikovsky died, I think, in 1976. By 1979, I'm at Cornell taking NASA space science and Voyager and Pioneer data, and telling them that it's proving that comets are not dirty snowballs, that comets are the discharge of the solar capacitor, that comets are getting larger and could become planets. Imagine that in the presence of Sagan. So needless to say, I stepped into a hornet's nest. But once again, Einstein was interested because he knew the key to understanding the full extent of general relativity to extend to the electric and magnetic fields had to understand what Velikovsky was talking about, and that's what I discovered. Okay, so there's all of these proofs in plain sight. Let's jump out to the Kuiper Belt planets. Now, about 20 years ago, or more or less, I don't know the exact amount of time, a guy named Michael Brown is doing automated searches of the sky and discovers a planet called Sedna. It's the very first extra solar system planet to be discovered in the Kuiper Belt beyond Pluto. And then all of a sudden there's other searches that go on, and hundreds, then thousands of new planets are discovered in what is known as the Kuiper Belt. Okay, good. Well, we were all taught as kids that there are nine planets: Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. But Pluto was kind of an oddball, a little planet out beyond the big gas planets. But it turns out to be one of thousands of planets that are out there. Now, what are planets doing out in that region of the solar system? Because according to standard theory, all the planets formed in this rotating dust cloud 4.5 billion years ago. So all of a sudden, you have thousands of new planets. So it goes from 9 to 9,000, and nobody wants to talk about that. So they have to demote Pluto from being a planet. Okay, so at any rate, the reason there all these planets are forming out there is because of the nebular ion cloud. The region that they are in, they are discharging the solar capacitor, they are forming planets, and you can see this in the microwave background radiation data. The blobs are actually moving. And so there again, this ties in with basic cosmology, and you can see these around other stars. They're called planetary nebulae. You can see the comets forming and the planets that are in these regions around stars. Okay, I'm going to pick up the pace a little bit here because I have a lot of material to cover. So then we go into the Planet X era, with Hale-Bopp being the literally Planet X that Harrington discovered. I have a book that you should read. It is called The Real History of Planet X 2020 Update. It discusses all of this about the CIA coming in and controlling NASA, the squelching of data, the forcing of tier two science onto the public and the peer review systems, once again corroborating with garbage science. Government funding, grant funding, Nobel Prizes, equipment, who controls the good equipment? And it turns out that the military has very good equipment, but you will never get to see that. For example, the infrared facilities on Haleakala in Hawaii, these are all military facilities. They come into regular facilities or the Hubble Space Telescope or the Webb Space Telescope and can take over. Now let's talk about the data recently acquired by the James Webb Telescope, showing that fully developed galaxies are sitting there right next to where the Big Bang happened, disproving finally the final nail in the coffin of cosmology, showing that it just does not work. It does not explain explanation. It does not explain observation. Let me just talk about something that's very important. It's called atheism in science. The reason that Carl Sagan needed the Big Bang and then evolution, biological evolution, is because it eliminates the need for a creator or God. So atheism is an essential part of cosmology. You have to understand that. And if the universe is existing as we see it now, an ongoing process, then there must have been a design, a designer, and that does not fit with modern cosmology. They misused Stephen Hawking's name. He was very much a very sane person when it came to understanding cosmology, and that we were just scratching the surface of understanding. And the selling of science through the medium like National Geographic or the History Channel, Discovery Channel. And I should quickly mention Tesla. Nikola Tesla made a comment about general relativity and cosmology and about the Big Bang and expanding universe. He said, science has become a series of mathematical projections that do not consort with reality. I've just about finished with this particular program, so once again, go to the webpage. There's so much more to talk about how science controls all of the other fields of study, geology, meteorology, archaeology, etc. This is what this course is about. I encourage you to go take up the entire course. It's called Eclipse, the New Cosmology, on my webpage, jmccsci.com. Once again, jmccsci.com for $89. Eclipsed, the New Cosmology. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.